then this approach and this path cannot end. So does a revolution that keeps pace with modernity in its local tools that it acquired from its knowledge system. The experience of the Islamic Revolution on its 43rd anniversary can only be understood through an objective, deconstructive, analytical approach in isolation from hostile attitudes and opposing ideologies in order to find out its true features, its major objectives, and its humanitarian goal that concerns all free peoples of the world. Now to discuss this issue with us from Athens is Lamprini Toma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thank you very much for being with us, dearest Lamprini. Now, the world after the Islamic Revolution in Iran is not the same as before it. The awakening that came after a set of setbacks that shook the popular resolve from the fall of the Mossadegh government in Tehran at the hands of the American and British intelligence to the deadlock of the National Project after the departure of Jamal Abdel Nasser and the betrayal of Sadat is nothing but an embodiment of the anger of the peoples of this Arab and Islamic region. In what ways, Lamprini, do you think that the Islamic Revolution resonate to the peoples of the global south of our planet who were eager to profess their identity, to restore their rights and dignity, and to grasp their role in the movement of history?
Thank you for having me. The Iranian Revolution is a rupture in history in more ways than other revolutions because it brings in the forefront not only the needs of the people, especially the people who survived the tyranny and brutality of colonialism. We must always remember that many peoples didn't survive, but also brought religion in the equation as the main expression of the traditions of the people, the civilization of the people, in our case, the Iranian people. Religion was part of the resistance and the fight against oppression and colonialism in Latin America and in Palestine. But in Iran, it was the main power. In a world where the two superpowers at the time, USA and USSR, thought it was forever dead and gone, it was a proof that you can win with God on your side, really, especially a God of martyrdom and sacrifice. And martyrdom and sacrifice are the secret weapons of all the popular fights in all the global south. Iranian Revolution embodies that in every possible way. The Iranian Revolution happened in a time when anti-colonial movements and anti-establishment movements seemed to win, and when the exploitation of the oppressed was starting to get new forms, when neocolonialism was starting to emerge as the answer to all the fight and the blood that we shed as people for our freedom and dignity, back from the West and the dominant East at the time. The depth of the beauty of that revolution, the fear it spread to the colonial powers and the power it gave to all of us, is shown in the war that followed right away, the Iran-Iraq war, and how the Iranian people managed by shedding their blood, as usual, to win that fight too. And I dare to say every fight after that one. Mm-hmm. That by itself makes it even today an inspiration for every people who continues to fight in the war.
Well, Lamprini, talking about the lively pulse of the revolution necessitates that we address internal developments that do not know any stagnation, especially in Iran, because the democratic movement is stable at every level, as we have witnessed over the past decades, and popular participation is the title of state building. This is what the leaders always speak about, popular participation with all its involvement of women that is rarely seen even in the largest democratic countries of this world. Now, why are the surrounding countries, the neighboring countries to Iran, afraid of such a model? Why not just embrace something similar instead of grasping to the old ways of tyranny and suppression?
Allow me to add two things. Iran continued to progress not only socially, economically, but also scientifically, while living under sanctions in that field too. Same happened with the Iranian military power. There is a little of the Cuban experience there. I think revolution teach each other, and that's a good thing. Second, the Iranian people are a lively and proud people that is not afraid to express their opinion or take the streets if needed. They are demonstrating and protesting when they see it fit because they are people of the revolution, and they want their states to be more revolutionary, be better, fight the ills of all states that will surface with time. Now, in the countries where we didn't succeed to overthrow colonialism and post-colonialism, we live under the spell of the media and the elites. Thus, the old ways of colonialism are easy. They sound modern. It's easy to accept that the West is the model we shall all follow. Elites reason in the post-colonial bubble of the superiority of the Western white men and of history as something that starts when they are born. Elites that do not know what the real civilization tastes like. That's mm-hmm. why the revolution is still something that they cannot comprehend, because it showed that time and history are totally different for the people, especially the oppressed, that they have their way to remember, to weave it in grassroots level, let's say, to weave there their own truth, their own civilization, in a way that it will survive every blow. And that if you don't respect that, the identity of the people will revolt sooner or later. And they will win sooner or later their independence. Mm-hmm. We tend to forget that independence means respecting the civilization of the people and the right to change their country themselves too. Independence is not a state thing, it is a people thing. Mm-hmm. Even modernization of the nations must be done with respect to the people's identity and tradition and be given time to mature.
Well, despite the arrogance of the West that we keep hearing against this revolution, the hostile invasion against this revolution from all sides and in all dimensions, the ideological and faith background of this revolution makes it a march that knows really no obstacles, because it's based on certain religious teachings that say there will always be a way to overcome hardships. What was the main drive that kept this wave going, Lamprini, for 43 years of stepping into light, denouncing darkness and submission to either the West or the East?
It is the unity that was brought to the Iranian society by those same words and measures which were made to break it. The Persians, the Iranians, are an ancient historic people with great knowledge of their identity and their history. Wars and sanctions are fuel to the generator of the revolution, mm-hmm. are themselves generators of resistance. Furthermore, the ones governing today are the revolution generation and the first generation after that. In the case of the Iranian revolution, the West reacts generally stupidly and vindictively, I think. They cannot understand the revolution and they believe they know everything. And they are still afraid of the Iranian people. They know where the power stands there. And they have seen their embassy turned into a museum of arrogance. It's a place that I loved when I visited now, after the revolution. Mm-hmm. The West does not believe that they can be friends with the revolutionary people, the people with identity. Thus, they are not really friendly in their approach towards Iran. And there never will be such an approach as long as the revolutionary spirit survives, which is something we all wish. And it has nothing to do with rights and religion, I should say that. You just have to see how friendly their approach is to Saudi Arabia to mm-hmm. understand that it's not that the case is not that. It has to do with the fear of barbaric raw power when opposite to a fruitful civilization with deep roots and a revolutionary tradition.
Well, it's so refreshing to hear such thoughts coming out from a lady who is, according to the map, a Western lady, but at heart is definitely from the Global South. I want to thank you very much from Athens, Ms. Lamprini Thoma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. I advise people to listen to her, to read her writings. It's absolutely refreshing. Thanks a million for being with us, Lamprini, and please stay tuned next week for more. Thanks a million. I'll see you next week.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration is ignoring desperate pleas from humanitarian organizations and UN human rights bodies, choosing instead to maintain policies virtually guaranteed to cause mass starvation and death of civilians, especially children. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Batinga Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. sanctions caused mass civilian deaths in Iraq. Afghan civilians are up next. Stay tuned, please, for the first part of this article. One million Afghan children may die from starvation over the next several months, according to the United Nations. Nearly 23 million Afghans are facing crisis levels of hunger and 8.7 million are on the brink of starvation. This mass hunger has rendered millions of Afghans on the verge of death, according to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Alongside looming mass starvation, Afghans face below-freezing temperatures, severe shortages of life-saving medical supplies, and extreme poverty, making conditions in Afghanistan among the gravest of human rights crises on Earth. This is not a natural disaster, nor is it the result of conflict internal to Afghanistan. This is a human-made humanitarian catastrophe, United States-made specifically. The U.S.-allied Afghan government, most recently under the rule of Ashraf Ghani, was heavily dependent on foreign aid. Following the Taliban takeover in mid-August 2021, the Biden administration and the UN Security Council instituted devastating sanctions, sharply reducing foreign aid. The Biden administration froze $9.5 billion worth of Afghanistan's foreign currency reserves, roughly equivalent to 40% of the country's gross domestic product. Journalists Ryan Grimm and Sarah Sirota recently reported that the White House has urged European partners and multilateral institutions like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to similarly starve the nation of capital. This has led to the total collapse of Afghanistan's economy, creating an almost globally unprecedented level of economic shock. Unemployment has skyrocketed and the country's healthcare infrastructure has been decimated. As experts have noted, more Afghans are poised to die from U.S. sanctions over the next few months alone than have died at the hands of the U.S. military forces over the last 20 years combined, by a significant margin. Yet, as journalist Murtaza Hussain recently wrote, U.S. establishment politicians and intellectuals who decried the humanitarian crisis during the fall of Kabul are seemingly unbothered by imminent mass starvation imposed by the U.S. The Biden administration is ignoring desperate pleas from humanitarian organizations and UN human rights bodies, choosing instead to maintain policies virtually guaranteed to cause mass starvation and death of civilians, especially children. Yet it is important to note and remember that as a member and matter of policy, this is not particularly new. The U.S. has often imposed harsh economic sanctions, causing mass civilian death. A previous imposition of sanctions resulted in one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes, one largely forgotten in mainstream historical memory. In 1990, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Iraq through the UN following the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. These sanctions continued for more than a decade after Iraq withdrew from Kuwait and had horrific humanitarian consequences, eerily similar to the imminent mass starvation of Afghan civilians. The sanctions regime against Iraq, which began under George H.W. Bush, but was primarily administered by Bill Clinton's administration, froze Iraq's foreign assets, virtually banned trade, and sharply limited reports. These sanctions crashed the Iraqi economy and blocked the import of humanitarian supplies, medicine, food, and other basic necessities, killing scores of civilians. The international diplomat, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and former Finnish president, Martti Ahtisaari, led the first UN delegation to Iraq shortly after the imposition of sanctions. The delegation reported that nothing that we had seen or read had quite prepared us for the particular form of devastation which has now befallen the country, unquote. The sanctions had produced near apocalyptic results. 2 years later, the World Food Program reported that the continuing sanctions had virtually paralyzed the whole economy and generated persistent deprivation, chronic hunger, endemic undernutrition, massive unemployment, and widespread human suffering. A grave humanitarian tragedy is unfolding, unquote. The consequences of the sanctions for Iraq's healthcare system were dramatic. Journalist Jeremy Schill extensively covered Iraq under these sanctions and reported that every pediatric hospital felt like a death row for infants. Highly trained Iraqi doctors had the knowledge to save these infants, but the sanctions blocked them from acquiring basic medical supplies and pharmaceuticals, forcing doctors to reuse syringes multiple times and ultimately watch children die of perfectly treatable ailments. Iraqi hospitals reeked of gasoline, Schill recalled, since desperate doctors were forced to substitute gasoline for sterilizer, disinfectant, and bleach. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq, Dennis Halliday, resigned his post in protest of the sanctions after serving as a UN diplomat for more than 30 years. During his resignation, he told the press that 4,000 to 5,000 children are dying unnecessarily every month due to the impact of sanctions because of the breakdown of water and sanitation, inadequate diet, and the bad internal health situation. He went on to label the U.S. imposed sanctions as genocide. His successor, German diplomat Hans von Sponeck, also resigned in protest after fewer than 2 years, calling the sanctions a true human tragedy that needs to be ended.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
شما در این قرن معجزه کردید. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, and the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. We are carrying on with these programs to shed light on the greatness of this great personality, Imam Khomeini. So, once again, I've got an expert in the studio, Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who's given us our valuable time, an Islamic scholar and researcher in the holy city of Qom, who has been guiding us through the life and times of Imam Khomeini. We spoke in the last program about the background, the holy lineage of the Imam, which is, you know, of great significance because he does come from the Holy Prophet's family, peace be upon them all. And of course, I'd like to say here at this moment that Imam Khomeini, really, as we will go through these programs and discover, he really gave us a glimpse of what our infallible Imams were like, because there's been a huge gap since the time of the great occultation of the 12th Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may God hasten his appearance soon. But we got a little glimpse in the last 30 years or so, something of what the Holy Prophet's family are like, and in terms of their character, their personality, their distinguishing virtues, their scholarship, of course, and their knowledge, you know, is always a cut above the rest. And, you know, he gave us a glimpse of that. But inshallah, God willing, as we go through these programs, we are going to shed light on this in greater depth. So, Sayyid Taqi, salam, and thank you very much again for being on the program and giving us your valuable time.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's great. So, Sayyid Taqi, we got to the stage, as we say, we were also putting in the background so that our listeners could understand that in what context all this was happening. And we got to the point where, you know, there are some interesting events happening around the town of Khomein. And we were talking about the fact that because of the Qajar dynasty was at its lowest point, you know, really they had no law and order. Things were pretty much at the end of that particular era. And the British, with their machinations and their imperialist agenda, were changing things here in Iran for the worst. And I'll emphasize that. So what was happening in Khomein at that particular moment in time where, you know, as you mentioned, we were getting to the history of Imam Khomeini's father in the town of Khomein?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, really, I mean, during that time between 1985, his birth, and and 1903 of his shahadat. And you say, what? His shahadat? Yes.
Yes, yes. His martyrdom.
You know, Imam
yes.
Khomeini's father was martyred.
Martyred, yes, of
and
course
And that area was raising a revolutionary alim-e-deen, revolutionary scholar.
Absolutely.
This the Sayyid Mustafa, as his name was, Sayyid Mustafa al-Khomeini. Mm-hmm. He was Imam Khomeini's father.
Yes.
As I said, born in 1885.
Yes.
He was sent to study Islamic studies in Isfahan.
In Isfahan.
Isfahan. Yeah. He did his most of his studies in Isfahan. And then after completing certain levels in Isfahan, he made his way to Najaf and Samar,
right.
And then come back to Khomein.
Right. So of course, at that time, Najaf was, you know, the central...
Indeed, that was the hub of...
The institution, the central hawza, you know, of...
Indeed, that was the hub of Islamic education
sure.
and learning.
Sure.
And on acquiring a substantially high quality of studies,
sure.
he returned back to Khomein.
Because, of course, in a later program, we'll discuss the fact that, you know, how the hawza system got established here in the holy city of Qum.
Indeed.
By
Indeed.
Ayatollah Yazdi, of course.
And there were other houses in Iran already. There were certain houses in Mashhad.
Mm-hmm.
There was a house in Iraq. There was
sure.
a house in Isfahan.
Sure.
Qum already had its own breeding point of ulama training.
Sure.
Not as a centralized institution.
Right.
But certainly if we look at a hadith from Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam, which talks about the fact that there will be a time near the zuhur of the 12th Imam.
That's correct. Yes,
where
that's a very famous
studies study. From Najaf would go down into the ground like
like a snake, and
snake
it would reemerge in Qum.
Exactly. And it just raises its head up in Qum.
Qum.
You're going back to Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam's tradition, Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam's tradition.
But of course the hawza in Qum took on a totally different color, but that's
indeed
something
but
else.
That is because of the nature of the revolutionized nature of the ulema that we're building around the various experiences of fatawa
sure.
given by
and we are not digressing by any means, because of course, you know, like the father of Imam Khomeini and Imam Khomeini himself, you know, they took central roles in the establishment of this Hawza system. So that it's even if we are mentioning it now, and of course we'll discuss it in depth in a different program, but it's important to mention that these are all elements into the building up of what we're discussing here.
Indeed, not only just elements, the fact that the nature of the Hawza's operative and how it will later on take on, like Imam Khomeini and others, to guide it, to define its, define and maintain its independence from oppressive regimes.
Yes, yes. No, this is very important. Yeah, the independence aspect.
You have Najaf, which was always independent from any environment to be able to dictate to it. And you see, that's why you've got Sayyid Mustafa Khomeini in Khomeini, his father, taking on a very strong position, a very hard position. Right. Against the oppressive Khans who were around there. You know, because of the fact that he was able to maintain that independence of the Ali Medin.
Of course, it has to be mentioned that these oppressive Khans were, at the behest of the corrupt ruling government, were taking lands.
No, they were taking land, but not only that, they were oppressing the people of that land.
Of course, I mean, they were...
And, because of the fact that Imam Khomeini's father was a independent thinking person...
Sure, and resisting this practice. Criminal practice,
And encouraging people to be resistance to them.
Yeah.
Yes, it meant in sacrificing life. A lot of people sacrificed their lives in Khomeini in being... firmly against these people. They were tortured, they were lamed, the bodies, they were injured in various types of injuries that they had to face. Mm. And of course, the very fact that the Khans or the oppressive authorities in those areas were looking at the public as if they were their personal servants.
That's right.
That Imam Khomeini's father stood up against that.
Of course.
And the fact that, there were so many others who were fighting amongst themselves as Khans to take up positions in front of the Shah of that time, that they would be even more evil than the last one.
That's right. The brutality was awful.
In this process of the brutality that existed, Imam Khomeini's father continuously stood up against these people. And it so happens, it's really interesting, thing one needs to analyze Imam Khomeini's life in relation to this. Because Imam Khomeini, being a younger member of the children of Sayyid Mustafa, he was experiencing things a lot more later on after his father's shahadat.
Yes, yes.
You see, because
after his
father's martyrdom. Because his father was martyred in 1903. And we're using the word martyr. Why? Because, you see, Sayyid Mustafa... he was seeing that the Khan of that time was very oppressive, taking up land, doing a lot of atrocities, in killing as well.
There was a violation of women's honor there
honor
as
and
well.
Everything. So what he, with a group of people of Khomeini, decided that they would go and visit the province's head, who himself was a corrupt so-and-so anyway. But the very fact that that type of audience was available just for the sake of demonstrating some type of interaction with the community, that these people on their way to represent Khomeini to the province's governor, that on the way there, the gangster of the time of Khomeini decided that he was going to eliminate them from reaching from before they were able to reach the governor and present them their case.
That's right. This is what is mentioned in the text, isn't it? That it was during his journey from Khomeini to Iraq or on the way back that this had happened. This awful crime had been committed.
And they shot him and he was killed.
Oh my goodness.
And of course, the people of Khomeini did eventually got their reward for...
The Qasas, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. For what had happened. Mm. But what I'm trying to say is that Imam Khomeini was experiencing, was in his bodily existence, had felt all these things that had happened around him.
Yeah.
But what was really important, I think, which needs to be brought into this context, is that we have hundreds and hundreds of ulema, thousands of ulema probably from 1920 up to now who have
That's
gone through the hawza.
I mean, men of great prominence.
But what made Imam Khomeini Imam Khomeini?
Exactly. That is the question.
That is a very important question. And one of those things which I personally feel is the way Sayyid Mustafa Khomeini felt it necessary to have Imam Khomeini raised in a particular way.
And that's what we want to talk about, because this background is very, very interesting and it does give us very important lessons in the raising of our own children.
You see,
as
what
well.
I found was something really interesting.
Mm,
and this
please.
was when Imam Khomeini was born, his mother could not feed him milk.
Right.
She was, and these are interesting correlating concepts. Right, Rasulullah Akram, when he was born, his mother could not.
That's right. He was given
to a wet nurse. But then that's interesting because he was given to
a
wet nurse. I mean, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala creates his own rationale for people to understand.
Yeah.
But it is a fact that the Jews of Medina knew of the fact that a prophet was going to be born. So they were always waiting for that time to get their guidance. But what was also a difficult thing was that they weren't going to allow the prophet to survive. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created an abnormality where the child would be taken out of the Quraysh's environment that they would not know where Muhammad was, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Interesting. Very interesting.
That's depriving them, the audience of him, and the fact that they could eliminate
even him. In Imam Khomeini's life, even at a very, very early stage, we're seeing parallels with the history of Islam.
The interesting parallel here is the fact that his mother could not. What changed the environment there is that not, God forbid, that his mother was not a spiritual lady, because she was.
No, she was a very pious lady, of course.
What happened was that when the child was given to the wet nurse, Imam Khomeini's father said that, look, you'll feed the child, but I will give you the food. I will supply you my own food. So that, you know, on one side he's talking about everything being absolutely halal from my own income. But then what he asked the wet nurse was really interesting. He says, every time you feed the child, I'll give you the food every month, but throughout the month, read a few surahs to the child whilst you're feeding the child.
The surahs from the Quran?
The Quran. When the month finishes and he takes her food, he said, did you fulfill that requirement?
Right.
So the lady says, sir, you said that I should do a few surahs whilst I'm feeding the child. During this month, I've read several Qurans in front of this child.
MashaAllah, my goodness, that is amazing.
You know, so this kind of spiritual, from spiritual out, you know, from the outset, he's being spiritually pasted. You know, the milk that the wet nurse is giving him is going to him while she's reciting Quran. He's listening to Quran whilst, you know, we think sometimes, what's a 2 month, 1 month child going to experience from this?
The other thing is that, you know, it begs the question, did the father have some insight as to, you know, the birth of this particular child? Already he was beginning to see something about
this? No, you
see,
what is important, brother, is that if you yourself are a spiritually minded person, you naturally do things which are the consequences of your spirituality.
That is true. That
you're
is
not kind
very
of planning
true.
Anything special.
No, but you're right. It's the complete culture, the complete
and that is
ethos
the culture.
In which
exactly.
he's...
And that was the culture that Sayyid Mustafa was embedded with. And he was passing it on
to his son.
His next offspring. In the same manner, his own son was known later on as Ayatollah Pasindide.
Yes,
he wasn't
yes.
anything small.
Yeah, we'll speak about him,
but
of
what
course.
I'm trying
yes.
to bring in this arena is that the spirituality of his father was also passed to him as well.
Yes,
he wasn't
yes.
anything, you know, the leftover of what was trained for Imam Khomeini that Ayatollah Pasindide came out of. No,
yes.
he was an entity of his own.
Own.
And he stood firm in his own identity.
Quite.
So yeah, his shahadat in 1903. Obviously, Imam Khomeini was only 5 months old.
Five months old at that time. Yes, yes, yes.
So you know, it wouldn't have a kind of "I saw what happened to my father" type of thing. But what was always reminded as an event, and that lineage of fighting the oppressed was already embedded in the bloodline,
which comes from the holy Ahlul Bayt all the time, because this is their martyrdom, their resistance at the of oppressors in their particular period, as we talk about the infallible imams, you know, is a tradition which was going to be followed by this holy family as well.
And in 1918, his mother and his beloved auntie
passed away
because of cholera.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, Imam Khomeini is only 16.
Is he 16 at the time? Yes, yes.
And you see again
the parallel that you can draw with Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly.
Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the loss of Hazrat Khadija and Hazrat Abu Talib.
The very fact that, you know, he's losing relatives who would be of a supportive...
Who were central in his upbringing. Yeah.
Exactly. So Imam Khomeini at 18... But then you see that's the demise of his mom and auntie.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is, as of I think it from the dates that I have scribbled down, is that from about 1906, mm-hmm. When he was about five years old,
right.
He's already studying Hosa type of courses. He started memorizing the Quran. He's reading the Quran. He's learning various
Quranic sciences exactly. at a very early age.
Sorry, 1908. When he was about 6 years old. As mm-hmm. of that time, when he was 6 years old, he's studying the Quran. He's memorizing the Quran, the recitation of the Quran, various Islamic holy books. He becomes familiar with as time goes on. You know, he and the Persian language.
Of course,
he starts mastering the Persian language and the whole old text of Persian languages.
Yes, yes.
He starts mastering them as time goes on.
Right,
that,
right.
You know, his studies, want for study, has already started.
Mm.
He's not playing around, so as to say. And left to listen to the next LP that comes out.
In other words, he's already following the Sunnah and the tradition of prophets from before, who, you know, you remind me of Prophet Yahya, actually, who was asked at one time to be playing with kids, and he said, "I'm not here to play around in life. Life was not created in vain." So, in other words, you know, you're already talking about a very powerful tradition in which, the scholarship is already manifesting itself at a very early age.
But then you see, alhamdulillah, when it comes to Islamic learning, you find that he's also learning the tools of life as well.
Right.
Learning how to ride the horse. He becomes an expert in horse riding.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He becomes expert in using defensive equipment.
He had a great love for sports at a very early age as well.
And you know, he knew how to defend himself with the weapons of the time.
Yeah.
You know, and
there's an anecdote or a story associated with that, because of, as you pointed out, with the situation with his father, you know, and what Khomeini as a town was going through because of the Khans. Imam Khomeini was very active in his teenage, learning the gun. And of course, they were already making what they call the bunkers, by which they were resisting these raids that were coming from these bandits.
Yeah. But you see,
it's interesting.
All the time, certain relatives were reluctant to see him. Maybe he would get killed or something
That's true.
He would still endeavor to learn the tools of the trade of defense at that time.
Yeah.
And it was,
and it shows him to be a very brave character right from the start.
Indeed, and when it came to target practice and things like that, he was one for the eye on targeting having a target at the necessary item. Mm-hmm. So you could see he's learning a vast range of expertise, which later on proved to be extremely essential in his own character building.
Right,
you know, and the fact that, whilst he is developing in his studies, you have, if we were to really break Imam Khomeini's life into certain phases,
we
can see that, you know, this is a second major phase of his building.
Yeah.
From the age of, you could say, 6 years old to 1962, a whole wide range of period of learning that Imam Khomeini is going through.
Absolutely.
For not only just learning, but also teaching.
Yeah,
that's to say, you know, more and more he's experiencing for himself, not really dabbing into any kind of confrontational situation.
I think, of course, you know, we'll do this in a later program, but I think the depth of the mastery of his scholarship and the fact that, as I say, we'll mention in the depth that even the students of Imam Khomeini, I mean, honestly, I mean, at times I'm taken back, drawn back to Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, alayhi salam, when, you know, scholars of other traditions used to come and ask him questions. And he would say, "Well, please don't ask me that question. Please ask my student."
My student
this question. Yeah. Just to see the competency, the mastery of the teaching of what he was disseminating. But as I say, that's a later
thing.
But
you see, what happened as we look at it in a chronological order.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Imam Khomeini, in about 1920, that's when the First World War is finished.
Yes. And dramatic changes have taken place in the war.
Changes have taken place.
In the Muslim world.
He's, alhamdulillah, at a stage where he's expanding his knowledge more.
Right.
You know, his brother, Ayatollah Pasandi, there, who arranges for
him.
Yes, his
tutelage was more with his brother, wasn't it?
His brother. And you find that his brother had arranged him to go and study in Isfahan. But instead of going to Isfahan, he's directed towards Iraq. And that
Iraq,
in itself, Iraq, that in itself has been an was an essential learning process for him.
We'd like to mention for a listener, Iraq is not confused with Iraq, but
it's a central province
of a town very near Qom.
And there the houses were being run, or there the main house in Iraq was being run by Ayatollah Abdul Karim Hari Yazdi. Mm-hmm. He was the one who was running that house and very well-established house as it was.
Yes, I mean, he was the founding father of, the establishment of the house as we know it today in Qom. But, of course, it came at a price because, the Pahlavis had now come into power, especially with Reza Pahlavi. And, of course, he was an army man, very brutal, very irreligious. He immediately put in the ban of the veil, which was following from Ataturk's thing, what he was doing with the decline of the Ottoman Empire. So a lot of things were happening which were very anti-Islam, very anti-Sharia. And of course, you know, there's that horrible story, but it has to be mentioned that when this Reza Khan came to Qom, the leading authority at that time, one of the Ayatollahs here, was beaten by the Shah in public, in a manner to try to humiliate him. But of course, the knock-on effect was different because, of course, in the public's mind, this brought out the true nature of the beast that the public was facing, especially here in Qom.
And you see, particularly with the fact that Ayatollah Hari Yazdi was a highly respected personality.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
His house or the management of the house in Iraq had a reputation of its own in training of ulema.
Sure.
That it could not be contested in any way whatsoever.
Right.
Particularly with Imam Khomeini going over there and experiencing at a very young age, a very tender age of 18 years old.
Yes.
That he's
really
kind of building his whole process of learning.
Sure.
From this environment, that when Ayatollah Yazdi moved the madrasa, moved the environment of the house from Iraq to Qom, which was in 1920 itself, that we see that Imam Khomeini doesn't hesitate in moving over with him.
He
finds that this is an opportunity not to be missed, and really and truly, where a lot of people may think, well, you know, some of our community people think, okay, I've studied 6 years, 7 years, let me go back to my community. No, Imam Khomeini wants to venture further
I think this shows something about, even at Imam Khomeini, even at as a teenager, he shows great insight, great depth and wisdom in his decision making of where he wants to go and study and what subjects he wants to study. Because, of course, he's taking on the Hawza studies, the traditional Quranic sciences studies, but he's also learning mathematics. He's also learning other subjects as well, which shows a wisdom and an intellect superior, perhaps even beyond his contemporaries, that exactly what kind of target, what kind of goals he wants to reach.
You see, but the goals, he keeps those goals under control. That's
true, because he's always against the ego, isn't he?
He's against the ego. But he was of a very important opinion that whoever is the leader of the Shia Ummah at a particular time should be the person responsible to dictate what the political environment should be.
Absolutely.
He did not venture out beyond his limits identified himself with relation to the leader.
But that shows a great wisdom in there.
No, not only just wisdom, but what it shows is the total nature of Shia opinion. You look at Karbala, if you look at Karbala, and
the divergence is allowed there.
Not only just divergence, the fact that recognition of the Imam of the time. You know, you had Imam Zainul Abidin al-Islam.
That's right, because
ill and everything. Yet still, Hazrat Zainab says, you're the Imam of the time, what should we do?
And the other thing is that we have to point out that even Imam Hussein al-Islam, who was a completely revolutionary character alongside his brother Imam Hassan al-Islam, but if Imam Hassan al-Islam stayed quiet during the rule of Bani Umayyah during Muawiyah's 20-year period, Imam Hussein was quiet as well.
And this is what we're learning from Imam Khomeini had learned, that when you identify identify with the leader of the time or whoever it is.
Sure.
That Ayatollah Hariri may be Ayatollah Hariri, may it be Ayatollah Bourjedi at a latter time.
Mm.
You do not venture beyond that. You can guide and you can support, but you do not venture behind the authority.
And I think that the support of Imam Khomeini at that particular stage is also very, very important. As you say, it does speak volumes in itself.
Indeed.
But we are going to carry on with that in the next edition of the program, where we will go further into the scholarship of Imam Khomeini, and then later on the works that he starts to come up as an accomplished scholar. And of course, he also achieved his becoming a mujtahid at a very early stage in his life as well. But we'll get on to that at a later program. At this moment in time, my dear audience, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have as well. So thank you for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings of Allah and His mercy be upon you all.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
In the present world, although the necessity for preserving human dignity has been referred to by international circles, conventions, and declarations, what we see in practice is that every day human dignity is trampled upon with the tacit approval of the US and major European powers who unabashedly support the Zionist regime terrorism against the Palestinian people, says Kahan International staff writer in an article titled The Necessity of Armed Struggle for Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Crises rise and abate all over the world, but the chronic question of Zionist-occupied Palestine persists with no solution in sight and no serious concern to the almost daily desecration of Islamic sanctities by the Zionist regime. Al-Aqsa, Islam's third holiest site, was again stormed the other day by armed Zionist thugs chanting slogans against the oppressed Palestinian people, while the Zionist regime security forces stood as silent spectators to the growing trampling of human dignity and rights. In the present world, although the necessity for preserving human dignity has been referred to by international circles, conventions, and declarations, what we see in practice is that every day human dignity is trampled upon with the tacit approval of the US and major European powers who unabashedly support the Zionist regime's terrorism against the Palestinian people. What should the people of Palestine, whether those living under direct Zionist usurpation in the West Bank, Beit al-Muqaddas, and in 1948 occupied areas, or in the small besieged sliver called Gaza do, when their plight knows no end? Not a day passes when they are not targeted by the usurpers of their homeland and are killed like sitting ducks by the Zionist regime troops and Jewish settlers streaming in illegally from various parts of the world to seize the lands of the Palestinians and to practice their skills with newly acquired rifles by taking pot shots at the helpless men, women, and children. And if the Palestinians dare to defend themselves, they are branded terrorists and denounced as heartless brutes, with the Western media joining the Zionists to highlight violent crimes against the peaceful and peace-loving Israelis. The UN, especially its Security Council, looks the other way, while the regimes ruling the Arab states have no interest other than lip service for the chronic question of Palestine and are now committing open treason by normalizing ties with the usurper regime of Israel. This has emboldened the Zionists to trespass with impunity on the sacred sites of Islam in Beit al-Muqaddas, as was evident the other day when the Zionist regime's troops and so-called settlers joined together to desecrate the holy precincts of Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is now time for the Palestinians to realize that mere protest in Beit al-Muqaddas, stone throwing at the heavily armed Zionists in the West Bank, and a few crude projectiles fired at occupiers from Gaza, although commendable acts, are not enough to scare their enemies, let alone drive them away from the usurped land of Palestine. In other words, only a well-organized armed struggle with asymmetric forms of modern warfare, including guided missiles and remote-controlled radar-evading drones, is the only solution to redress their plight that requires fed sacrifices in view of the savage, racist, and terroristic nature of the fabricated regime of Israel. It is certainly no crime nor terrorism for an oppressed, occupied, and usurped people to acquire whatever forms of defense equipment that is possible to procure through any means in order to protect their life, their dignity, their religious sites, their land, their families, their faith, and their cultural heritage. The important point, however, is to be on guard against pressures, threats, and deception of both the implacable foes like the US, Britain, and France, and those Arab regimes now openly dallying with the Zionist regime, such as the UAE and Bahrain, with the Saudis covertly conversing with the Zionists. To be more precise, unless the Palestinian people resist and refuse with firm conviction any of those much-tried useless methods of talks, negotiations, and mediation that have yielded no results over the past 7 decades, their situation will never change, let alone their steady slide into not just second or third class citizens, but slaves of the Zionists in their own ancestral land. An important point to note is that defense technology, in addition to being available on the international market, can be assembled through accessible data on the websites, and there is no shortage of helping hands. All it needs is ingenuity by the Palestinians, as the Yemenis have shown, with complete trust in divine assistance and full confidence in their own abilities.
We say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Wall Street has bought more than $60 billion, and that's billion with a B, worth of housing. Giant companies now own hundreds of thousands of single homes. Many renters have to deal with corporations to rent a home, and many have to compete with rich companies to purchase a house they've been saving up to buy. Entire neighborhoods are being bought up by these companies to make profits out of rent, driving up prices of homes, and many families are being forced to evict. Now, companies are taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis to buy foreclosed homes, and now the dream for an American to own a house has turned into a nightmare.
Corporate landlords.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll speak about corporate landlords in America, how large corporations have taken advantage of economic crises and bought up a massive number of homes. What are the problems with renting from a corporation? How has it become extremely difficult to buy a home while you need to compete with Wall Street? And what has the government done to help the ordinary citizen in this crisis? As usual, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show. Rafiki Morris, who is an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and Alex Powers, who's an opinion journalist. Please stay with us.
Giant companies now.